Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mark, as the amount of direct pool projects are multiplying literally by the day, it's really becoming the wild, wild west out there with so little regard to securities laws.
Wild, wild west, so they're making up their own rules?
Well, kind of.
Okay.
People are forgetting that we're still talking about a securities offering.
And with security offerings, that means security documentation, right?
Securities documentation, which is part of any EB5 project.
Which is why on today's show we have, returning back on EB5 Investment Voice, Michael Hohmeyer. Michael practices in the area of securities, corporate, transactional, and business financing law, including EB5 regional centers and, of course, direct pooled projects, investment crowdfunding, and blockchain token offerings. Michael has nearly four decades of experience in corporate and business transactional fields.
That's why he's our favorite securities expert.
He's laughing. Like, Michael, I take that as experience, four decades. So don't take that as a knock.
No, I agree with you. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be with you. This is a really vital topic. I'm happy to chime in.
Thank you. Michael, what is wrong with everybody? I have had argument after argument with developers who have had their documents drafted by some top attorneys, but I'm arguing with them because they somehow think because they have only four or six investors rather than 66 that they don't need securities documents.
Well, that's a huge mistake, but it feels eerily familiar to what we were fighting against back in 2009. It's really back to the future, but it's the cowboy installment where we're going back to the Wild West days that's been mentioned, and we're dealing with people who would rather not have to deal with the reality that any issuance of an investment opportunity to an investor who is not going to be active in managing the business, as well as some who are going to be active in managing the business, is a securities transaction, and the securities laws apply, and one ignores that requirement and fails to comply at their peril. There's going to be a shootout at the OK Corral with all the folks who aren't paying attention, who think they'd like to avoid the complexity and the cost of having to do securities compliance, but they can't.
That's what I feel is happening, because they are only four investors or stuff. They don't want to pay the money that it costs. Let's be honest here. It does cost money to do securities documents.
It does.
Because it takes a lot of time. But I'll tell you another thing. It costs a lot more to litigate. And when you don't have a securities documents, for all those developers out there who don't want to spend a little extra money at this point, so many things can go wrong. But Michael, tell me, just state it out for our audience. A direct pooled has the same provisions, requirements as a regional center offering. Yes or no?
Absolutely, yes. And that means that you could be selling to a single investor who isn't going to be active in managing the business. And let's face it, most EB5 investors have minimal participation in management of the business. If you have a single investor, then the securities laws apply to cover that person. Believe me, there's no exemption under the securities laws that say they don't apply if you've got five or fewer investors or one investor. They all apply to protect all investors under all circumstances. The question is, practically, what do you do in order to show the SEC, who are the financial cops, that you've complied with your securities law compliance obligations? You can do it with paper, which is the preferred route, or you can do it by actually giving somebody the opportunity to actively participate in the business and therefore protect themselves by their participation.
I think that's where the confusion lies. I think people think that because they're participating as a manager, perhaps, they don't need it. They don't need a securities document. And then that same issue has been translated across the line.
Well, I think you're right. And unfortunately, again, that gets twisted. People think if I'm active, then my buying an interest in an LLC is not a securities transaction. Well, that's not true either. That's the flip side of the coin, but that's equally untrue. Just because you have management power and the opportunity to exercise control to some extent over how your investment is being managed does not mean that you are not governed by the securities laws. You are, and you're entitled to their protections too. What the law says is if you have the right to manage and you are actively engaged in management, then you are satisfying the protective obligation by the fact of management. Where there is the right to manage, but people don't actually do it, or there is no right to management, then the only way to protect yourself and show compliance with the disclosure obligations is through the use of paper. And this becomes a game with some people, but believe me, the folks who come in to play it, like the SEC, the Department of Justice, the FBI, these are not game players.
No.
This is a serious task.
So I have a few questions for you here, Michael. Number one, developers who pick up an investor who might be an H-1B candidate, when there's a ton of those. I think in today's marketing world, a lot are overseas, but a lot are local people here in the U.S. on H-1Bs. Are they still required to file a Form D filing if it's a direct pooled project?
They are required to file a Form D project.
Form D filing.
The Form D filing is a notice filing of a Reg D exempt claiming securities offering. So if the securities are being sold to the investor, exempted from federal and state securities laws by claiming the Reg D, the Regulation D exemption.
Which happens when they're in the U.S.
Which happens if they're in the U.S.,
yep.
Then a Form D must be filed with the SEC. And that is regardless of whether the investor invested through the use of paperwork or through the use of no paperwork and merely has an active role in managing the business and protecting his investment through that management. Either way, there is a securities transaction that has happened. And that if that transaction claims the Reg D exemption, then a Form D has to be filed with the SEC about that transaction. And remember, it's only in connection with the sale of the investment opportunity, the sale of the security.
Right.
And however those securities are labeled, whether it's shares of stock or it's LLC interests or it's limited partner interests, they're all considered a purchase of equity, which of course is required under the EB-5 program.
Well, some people might know it as an EDGAR filing also, EDGAR. But the point is that there's no 924 filings for USCIS. So I feel like because there isn't that, a lot of developers are, well, this is easy. We don't have to do any filings.
But the 924 filing satisfies the immigration masters. And of course, an EB-5 project has to satisfy the program's requirements and deal with the immigration side of things. But again, setting those aside, it's also a financial transaction. It's the sale of a security, whether that security is an EB-5 connected security or not an EB-5 connected security, it's still a security. And the securities laws separately require what they require, entirely distinct from immigration law compliance.
You know, Michael, I have another quick question for you.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the offerings I am seeing right now out there are actually done by or put out by regional centers who
yes.
want to put in a direct project as opposed to a regional center offering. And they're still going back to the project and getting, for want of a better word, a commission per year for raising the capital. However, under a regional center offering, they're exempt from some of the rules and regulations because they are renting their regional center. Here, there's no rental of a regional center. Isn't this just a direct commission broker-dealer issue?
Well, it is, and it's a very serious issue. The regional center projects will usually have a two-entity structure where the investors are buying into a separate funding company that aggregates all their money and deploys that money over to the job-creating development entity or business entity. And you have those two entities, and the regional center principals, in addition to sponsoring the project through their regional center and satisfying the regional center EB-5 program requirements through that sponsorship, are wearing a second hat where they are the principals of the issuer that is sourcing their investors and putting the investors into that funding company. And there is no brokering issue, which is a salesman regulation under the securities laws that says if someone is engaged in selling as a salesman, someone else's securities deal, they have to be registered with the SEC or FINRA. There is not that requirement upon an issuer that is essentially raising investors for themselves. They're not considered a salesman for themselves. They're just doing it for themselves.
Ah, thank you for that regulatory information, Michael. But tell me, how does this affect direct pooled projects? Are there any special considerations, or can they otherwise go about things differently?
In the direct EB-5, you do not have a two-entity structure. You have a one-entity structure.
Exactly.
And the regional center folks who are assisting with bringing investors into a project which they are not the issuer of or a partner of the issuer, then they are essentially selling somebody else's deal instead of their own.
So it's a whole different scenario.
And under that scenario, they are salesmen. And of course, the securities laws would treat them as brokers, and almost none of them have their own broker registration.
Right.
And that means unless they are brought in as true partners of the issuer and participating in responsibilities beyond merely sourcing of investors, then they have serious broker registration non-compliance issues that they and the business they're trying to find the investors for can very easily run afoul of. And of course, that's a serious mess.
I had this conversation with a developer recently, and you know what I got in response was, the SEC aren't interested in EB-5 anymore. They're too busy running after crypto and SPACs.
That sounds like a dubious legal strategy.
The SEC is interested in whatever's going on that's illegal, and they're interested in putting a stop to it. And if it's big enough or important enough, or it just happens to catch their attention, they will step in. They were very active early on in EB-5 when, under the Regional Center program, people were misbehaving and investors were being defrauded. And it wasn't only the big mega EB-5 projects with regional centers that had hundreds of investors. It was smaller ones as well. And you can find the cases that were addressed by SEC. Most of them settled out. But remember, the first one with the Indian regional center case out of Chicago, that whole mess was not the largest EB-5 case, but it was a significant case. The issuers were very transparent. And the SEC not only did an enforcement action, but brought in the Department of Justice that did a criminal prosecution because they wanted to point out to everybody that the securities laws apply to EB-5. And believe me, if the SEC believes it's important to remind everyone that the securities law compliance requirements apply in direct EB-5, in addition to in regional center EB-5, I wouldn't expect them to hesitate for a second to find an appropriate case to bring.
I agree. And we've been involved in a securities investigation of a direct pooled. So
okay,
it's not like they don't. Yeah, exactly.
Well, see, that disproves what the developer said right there.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was arguing about.
You can even hear him driving by in the background.
Of course, the siren would come into play the moment we start talking about what the SEC will go after.
I hope they're going down the street, you know?
This is New York for you. But, you know, I would not be surprised if we start getting, you know, an amended I-924, which included direct pooled, because I feel like the longer the regional center program, you know, does not get its reauthorization, the more direct pooled projects and the more fantastic and sort of, you know, particular type ones, which are all over the country, are going to come up. And the more we're going to see this.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, again, just like with the regional center program 10 years ago, part of the increased risk environment was as a result of the program's success.
Right.
So when there's more activity, there's some percentage of bad people, and eventually it gets attention. And the case here, I'm sure, is going to be repeated. Most folks want to do the right thing the right way, which you can do. And even if you have to pay a bit more in order to do it the right way, you can still do it the right way and you can be successful in achieving your business objectives. But there are always inevitably some group of people who want to cut corners and they want to do things without complying with the securities laws. Those folks are going to get their project in trouble. They're going to get their investors in trouble. They're going to get themselves in trouble. And I really think it's a cheap form of insurance to go to bite the bullet, spend the additional money to document your compliance with the securities laws and get the investors the protection to which they are entitled. And frankly, they deserve by giving them thorough offering documents that disclose all the material risks, the investment opportunity before they're allowed to make that investment. That can be done in the direct world, just like in the regional center, and it can be done cost effectively and it can be done successfully in a way that protects both investors and the people behind the project.
Hey, Mona, let me ask you, do you think this advice is more applicable to the developers than anybody else?
No, we're talking to everyone.
Yes.
Because I feel that the investors should understand that if a project doesn't have a PPM, you know, first of all, are they cutting corners, which is not a good thing. But within the PPM, you have all your risks outlined. You should know what you're putting your money into. And you don't really always get all of those factors put into just a business plan. You need to see a PPM.
Well, that's an excellent point. There's a second excellent point that follows along exactly behind that. And that is that when people are not given their disclosures about the investment opportunity in writing, then as the time goes by and the years go by, people's memory about what it was they were told or what it was they researched or what it was that they learned when they came into the business, assuming that they're going to be active and that they're going to not have paper. The problem with that is their memories change and people's memories change differently. And so what people remember about what they knew or what they were told or what they understood subjectively, perhaps without telling anybody else, and what other people knew or what they understood or what they thought was the reality of this business opportunity at the time back years ago that it got started, those can change as well. If you want to keep everybody on the same page, literally, if you have it in writing, it's very clear what was said at the time that the investment was offered. What was the roadmap that the business laid out for itself in those papers? And in the years since, did the business do what it said it was going to do or did it not? The easiest way to prove that when people's memory fade over time or differ over time is to have the documents in writing that lay it out clearly in black and white. It's there. If it's in the documents, that's what's disclosed. If it's not in the documents, it wasn't disclosed. If it's in the documents, that's the roadmap that the company either followed or didn't follow in the years that that transpired after. So you can see how even when investors are going to be somewhat active or potentially even very active in the business, there is a lot of utility in having the documents done on paper, despite the cost. And I will admit, to be transparent, I'm a lawyer who earns money writing these documents. So I guess anyone would say, well, of course he's going to say people should hire him to write the documents because they all need those documents. But if I disappear off the earth tomorrow, their securities law obligations would still remain. And people's best protection, both for the investors and for the business, would be to have those documents on paper.
You're talking about just business issues, Michael. Look at what's happened in EB-5 in the last 6 months. We've had more changes, more disruptions in the last 6 months than we've had in the last 30 years.
Yes.
It's literally crazy. And all of these things, again, are should be down there as risk factors. But let me ask you, if somebody really is tight on money and they don't want to pay for a full-blown securities document, is there a shorter version of a PPM that might suffice?
Unfortunately, the answer is always going to be no, not just because I'm a guy with a conflict of interest, okay? I'm self-motivated to find work. But honestly, I try to set that aside and put on my professor hat and say to people with that kind of a question, look, you get as much protection as you pay for. In other words, the longer documents are, the more thorough they are, the more detailed they are, the more they're going to cost. Yes, you can do a half-baked job and you can include half of the risk factors and half of the information about the business and half of whatever other requirements about sharing information you should have included, but you're going to do it on a half-baked basis and hope that those are the only issues that ever come up. And if they are, then you're covered because the 50% you chose to talk about in order to get a 50% reduction in cost by having a half-baked document, if that's where the trouble comes from, then you're protected because you've got at least those things discussed in your papers. The problem is, of course, if you get tagged for something that wasn't addressed. And of course, it's those areas that aren't addressed where people's minds differ and their memories change. And people say, I was never told this. And you have no way to prove that you did tell them because it's not in writing. Most of the trouble that's going to come about is going to come about by what is not said, what is not disclosed to investors. So, you know, better to have a half job than no job. But honestly, the more that a business is willing to cover and the more thorough the disclosures that it makes, the greater the protection that it earns for its investors and thereby the greater the protection it earns for itself. And look, a $50,000 document is going to earn in the legal fees that it can help make go away or never come about in the first place. It's going to earn its way in gold later on down the years. I honestly believe that. And I think that the litigation that you see in EB-5 is over people who have not made disclosures. They omitted it, or they only did a half-baked job, or they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And they're measured against the track, the roadmap that they laid out in their documents.
A lot of course, direct pooled projects are all equity offerings. And I get asked all the time, do we have to disclose the various corporations and their bios and the backgrounds in detail, real detail, in these projects? Because it's much more involved than a regional center where you can have a specific little company where everything is brand new. In this type of offering, especially if it's an existing business, there's a lot more disclosure. How much does a PPM have to disclose?
It has to disclose however much it has to disclose. And oftentimes you don't know that until the end of the day when you find out not enough was disclosed. But up front then, if you know that that's a reality, the more you choose to disclose about, the greater the level of protection. Everything you tell an investor is something he can't later claim he wasn't told about and didn't know about, and therefore couldn't factor it into his investment decision. So look, you know, even if there isn't any black letter rule that says go from A to P, and then once you get to Q, you can stop. There isn't a rule like that. But I would tell somebody, look, as far into the alphabet as you can go, you know, the more that you choose to include, the greater the level of protection for the investor and for the business. So it's, and I recognize, and I have clients too, who say, look, I have a budget. I can only afford to spend so much. Then I would tell them, I advise you based on over 500 projects over the last 12 years that I have worked with in the securities area in EB-5, both indirect, regional center, and direct, the more you can afford, afford as much as you can, okay? That buys you the greatest protection for your investors, and therefore it buys you the greatest protection for yourselves.
Michael, another requirement which I've noticed is missing. Again, people think that direct pool projects don't, we can suddenly forget all the rules and regulations, is that of being an accredited investor. Again, many, many investors are local people. They're local. They come under the Schedule D's issues. Do we still need to be an accredited investor? Do we still need to show that requirement?
The answer is yes. If the offering is required, is depending upon the exemption afforded under Regulation D, then Regulation D requires at least the most standard subcategory of exemption, which is the 506B or 506C under Regulation D offering, then those are required to have accredited investors only, with a wrinkle that no one cares about, which says if you bring in any unaccredited, you're limited to the number and you have to give them super additional amount and detail of disclosure. And everybody sees that and says that's completely impractical and ridiculously expensive. And so therefore, no one ever talks about the unaccredited investors. All they ever talk about is the requirement that therefore all the investors have to be accredited. And again, it depends upon if you're using the Reg D exemption. If you're using the Reg D exemption, it doesn't matter if you're indirect regional center or direct EB-5 offering. The regulation requires that the investors be accredited, and therefore they have got to be accredited.
Well, you know what I see why people started forgetting about the accredited investor issue is because when we went up to 900,000, by the time fees and everything were added, it was a million plus. So really, that issue just went out of the window.
But remember, Mona, you and I have dealt with some sophisticated scenarios where those simple people get mixed up as they look at $1 million net worth and they think, well, if the investor's got $900,000 under an increased EB-5 subscription, they've got $900,000. Well, that's almost $1 million, and that indicates their net worth is $1 million. Now, once they make the investment, though, under certain circumstances, they could be deemed to have taken that $900,000 of net worth and have invested it somewhere where the value is no longer $900,000. So the value may be $900,000, but it may be less, or it may be incapable of being recalculated until such time as the investment is withdrawn from the project into which it was invested. So what you take $900,000, or you even take $500,000, and you like to think you've still got $500,000 invested into that project. But whether you do or you don't for purposes of the investment is an open issue. And you cannot automatically say, if I've got $1 million of net worth shown, of which $900,000 is my EB-5 investment, and now it's back down to $500,000, then I satisfy the requirement for accredited investor. Although, again, the flip side to that is that you may. Either way, the company has to say that it is restricting itself to taking accredited investors only, and that it needs to get from the investor a self-certification from the investor, or a third-party certification if they're using the 506C exemption instead of the Reg D 506B exemption, which does not, the C exemption does not allow self-certification of accredited investor status. And they have to go out and hire a third-party verifier, or the company has to hire a third-party verifier. But either way, it isn't enough to accept somebody saying, oh, by the way, I'm accredited. It has to be either certified by an independent third-party financial evaluator, and they give a written certification both to the investor and to the company that the person's accredited, or if they're self-certifying, they still have to fill out a form that is more than just a signature. They have to check boxes actively telling the company how they have the net worth, or perhaps it's the net income, the other standard for proving they're accredited. Either way, it can't be a simple statement. It has to be in writing in order to protect everybody. And it has to be something that the company can rely on in meeting the requirement under the Reg D obligation that the investor is, in fact, an accredited investor.
Michael, though, people have asked me whether or not they could get a denial from their EB-5 petition if they're not accredited investors. I mean, this is securities laws. It really is not EB-5 immigration law.
That's correct. And EB-5 does not require that the investors be accredited, but the securities laws do. Just like if you're considering investing in a non-EB-5 investment, that investment has to comply with the securities laws, even if it's not complying with the EB-5 program because it's not an EB-5 deal. So again, both of these sets of laws coexist at the same time, and everybody has to satisfy both the immigration requirements and the securities law financial requirements.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about why investors need to be accredited, why that requirement is still there, as well as projects, the importance of a private placement memorandum, when to file Form D, it sounds like pretty much all the time, and what's required. And you also mentioned at the top of the show regional centers that are continuing to sell EB-5 offerings, but no longer under their rented regional center. It's now someone else's project that they don't have control over. And you mentioned that they should have some type of brokerage agreement. Could you expand a little bit more on that and what they would need to do to satisfy that requirement?
Sure. So brokering is a job. It's a salesman function. Anybody can do it. And they can be a regional center or former regional center or people who are involved in a regional center otherwise. But in this particular case, because it's direct, their regional center has nothing to do with it. But they are utilizing, leveraging their expertise, knowledge, and education that they've gained over years of working on regional centers to now become active in the direct world of EB-5. When they are not in the regional center program, raising money, sourcing investors of their own, but they're doing that function for someone else, that's the salesman function.
What's the first step that they need to do to become registered as a broker so they can begin to start to fulfill this requirement? What's the first step?
So the broker requirement is that the person doing the salesman function be educated and be licensed. That means they have to have taken a series of examinations and then earn the title of a broker or broker dealer. They have to be affiliated with a firm, a broker dealer firm. They have to have a license with SEC or FINRA registration. So they have to both be educated and exercise a role under government supervision with government guidance and often a financial obligation that they post some kind of a bond or financial reserve.
But Michael, we know that many of the regional centers are not broker dealers. They're not licensed, but they're relying on just having a regional center. And you mentioned that they should have an equity ownership.
There is an exemption from the brokering rule that says if you use a broker, that salesman must be licensed and registered with FINRA. The exemption is if the person who is selling for his own company. Now, the problem with that exemption is it gets very fact specific and very complicated. But again, the bottom line of it to ever work is where the individual is selling for himself, essentially selling for his own company. Because remember, a broker is considered a third party salesman who's selling for someone else. He's not getting investors for himself. He's bringing investors to somebody else's deal.
So you're referring to the issuer's exemption.
The issuer exemption.
Right.
Unless the broker is inside the issuer, then he is a third party and he's therefore covered by the broker requirement. The exemption is the issuer can broker for itself and therefore its principals can broker for it. And they are exempt. They're not considered to be brokering. The problem with the broker exemption is it is very fact specific and it's very complicated and it can easily be violated by people who just get a 1% partnership stake or LLC interest in the issuer, and they're really doing nothing other than sourcing investors. The SEC doesn't want that activity to be done without it being licensed for somebody who is not really the owner of the business for which he is bringing in investors. So if the SEC sees a game is being played and it's one of form, and that in fact, there is not the substance that the person who's bringing in the investors was actually inside the company and a principal or a partner of the issuer, then the SEC is going to come after him and say, look, you're an independent broker. You don't have the issuer exemption. It doesn't cover you. And therefore, where's your license? And if you don't have it, serious repercussions.
So it sounds like essentially, as you were saying, the education requirement really comes in and that knowledge requirement comes in when you're selling.
Oh, and the licensing requirement.
And of course, the licensing requirement that hinge off that education and knowledge when you're selling somebody else's stuff. That requirement is taken away when you're selling your own stuff because it's known that, well, you probably know your things that you're selling. But if you're selling someone else's, look, there's all sorts of questions and things that you need to discover before you sell it to someone else. And I guess that's where the licensing requirement comes from.
Well, and this is where the regional center folks get themselves into trouble because they forget that they are no longer under direct sourcing investors for themselves most of the time.
Maybe that's where that confusion comes in because they feel like they know as much as if they were selling their own.
Sure.
The day before it was their own and now that requirement's gone.
Exactly right.
And Mark, Michael is absolutely spot on because we have seen instances where the SEC have gone after people who've used the issuer's exemption, but said you've improperly used it.
Right. And it's our hope that this episode will inform and educate those people to stop doing that. Michael Hohlmeier, thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining to us the important security documents for these direct pooled projects, why they are so important, and who can benefit from fully understanding them.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.